Podcast of the cinema.
Brought to you by this. What kind of coffee is this?
Of course, I make the worst coffee and you love it.
No. Oh, is this this isn't your gross Spanish coffee?
No, this
Spanish
isn't my
coffee?
Like fancy Spanish coffee. This is Maxwell House, Dave White.
Oh, we need more of that. Like, I don't have coffee in this house.
Yeah.
I drink tea.
Okay.
Because I'm Judi Dench.
And when you drink coffee, you suddenly become Cuban because you want to basically have a mug of
I
hot
need
milk
half
with like
the,
a little thing of coffee
I need all
on
the milk
the side
and then half the
to
coffee.
Like make it a little brown.
But get more. Is there more?
There's more.
Keep this in the house because right. If I need coffee, then this is what I need to
okay.
have.
I
good.
For
like 1945, I'm in a diner. That kind of coffee. That's the coffee.
All right. Whatever makes you happy, Dave. Also brought to us by our wonderful club members.
That's where I was going next.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Have you subscribed to us? You should subscribe to us. It's very inexpensive. It's $4 a month. If you're cheap, like me, it's more. If you're rich, like people I don't know.
Listener Croesus, who writes in.
We don't need to go on and on about that today because we have a guest.
We do.
Oh, so, we need to introduce ourselves first.
Yes, sorry.
You
yes.
are?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, and you're Dave White.
And what do you do?
I am the film reviews editor for The Wrap. I am a film critic on What the Flick on YouTube, and I'm here.
I'm a film critic who gets paid by whoever assigns whatever to me.
There you go. So here's a fun fact. Did you know that one out of every eight podcasts recorded in America features our guest today?
That's correct.
Travis McElroy is here.
Hi. That might actually be true at this point.
Yeah, it's bananas. Let me see if I can just do this off the top of my head. You are, of course, the co-host of My Brother and Me. Also, The Adventure Zone, Interrobang, Bunker Buddies, Schmanners, Can I Pet Your Dog, and Trends Like These.
Yeah, and we actually have an eighth one that's very secret. It's not secret. It's okay. It's the weirdest concept one we do that I think listeners of this might actually enjoy the most.
Is this the Blart one?
Yes,
right?
It's Till Death Do Us Blart. We do one episode a year.
Yes.
So it's okay if you haven't heard of it. And so far, we've only done one episode. Every American Thanksgiving, we watch and review Paul Blart Mall Cop 2.
Right.
And it's me and my brothers, Justin Griffin, and Tim and Guy from The Worst Idea of All Time.
Yes.
We intend to do it for the rest of linear time. We have committed to that when one of us dies, we will be replaced, and the show must continue forever.
This is why all the McElroy wives are pregnant. So
yeah,
that we
have to. Originally, it was going to be my friend Stuart Wellington, who's on the Flop House.
Right? Yep.
I have already announced that he has to do it, and so he routinely from time to time, will send me care packages to make sure I'm in good health so that he never has to do it. But now, if my daughter comes along and she's funny enough, he may be off the hook. Well, I'm not going to commit to that yet because I still want to make him do it if I die before that time
that
comes.
That seems kind of Games of Thrones-y. Like, by the way, daughter, you have no choice but to watch Paul Blart Mall Cop
I will
2.
Train her from birth to be funny. Well, I was planning on doing that anyways. So a very strict, funny household for me.
I met Tim and Guy when they came. They did their season one finale at the Cine Family, and I interviewed them for The Wrap for one of the very few on video things I've ever done for them, and they're a hoot.
They're not only super funny, they're also like two of like the nicest dudes and super enthused. I think so their concept for the show, for those of you at home, is that they watch and review the same bad movie every week
for a year.
And the first season was Grown Ups 2, the second one was Sex and the City 2, and now they're doing We Are Your Friends. And it's a brilliant concept for a show, but it also helps that they're like so strangely enthusiastic about terrible things in a way that I've never, like heard anybody else be that's like wonderfully pleasant and very upbeat. We had him on an episode of Bunker Buddies about staying positive in like the post-apocalypse, just because like their ability to like go into what should be terrible and make jokes the whole time and find humor in terrible things is just
wonderful.
They're very
glass half full.
Yes, very much so.
I didn't know Bunker Buddies existed until recently.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I heard you talk about it once on My Brother and Me, but when you guys talk about all the other podcasts that are happening in your lives, I just think, I don't have time.
So I do 27 episodes a month of something, and that's not including guesting. Oh, we just yesterday recorded 5 episodes of Bunker Buddies in one day, where we recorded from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m.
Well, I'm obsessed now with it, because as a person who likes to make sure that
the go bags.
All right, well, he doesn't have to go see them, but they're like, they're right there by the door. I'm that weird person that wants, you know, to live.
Yeah.
And so when I found out this, he played it for me this week. I was like, how have I not been paying attention to Bunker Buddies? It's so very good.
The weirdest thing about it is like when we started the show, it's now in its second year. When we started the show, Andy was very like, she's actually from a family that like preps and like takes it all very seriously. And I was kind of like, yeah, I'm interested in like, you know, surviving. And I watch a lot of like, I get scared during horror movies, and since I was like 6, I've been thinking about how to survive like vampires and stuff. And so then started doing the show, and now 2 years in, I'm like, it's not like I'm saying we all need to live off the grid and flee to the woods, but I'm looking at like, yeah, having a go bag, knowing like your escape routes, right. And like, because stuff does happen. Like in the same week, we just talked about this on an episode, in the same weekend, Andy's hometown like was struck by like massive forest fires, and my hometown was flooded like in the same weekend. And we're like, yeah, this kind of like, maybe it's not aliens, but there are earthquakes. Like, that's
you might have to get up and go.
Yeah, that's like a real thing that happens.
I just watched the Werner Herzog documentary about the internet, and it's basically like one sunspot is going to take out the whole thing, and then everything is screwed, because like all the like the food distribution networks are all connected to the internet. Like, just trucks are not going to go. Everything is going to be a disaster.
Yes. It's a scary thing, but I also think that's one of the tricky things about the show is, like, my older brother refuses to listen to it because it gives him panic attacks, or he's just like, yeah, it makes it too real. Nope.
Well, that's why I've had panic attacks about this my entire life, since childhood, when I saw the Poseidon Adventure for the first time. I was like, how will I get out of that boat?
It's all too real.
I'm always going to I get on a boat, the first thing that's going to happen is going to turn upside down. I have to figure out my way out.
See, but that's why I do stuff like this, because I love plans, and I love making plans. Like, I was a technical director for a theater for 6 years, and my favorite thing about it was like sitting down and mapping out the next like 4 weeks of saying like, yep, that's
I fully understand this
you
impulse
are the Dave White of the world.
This is every step, and this is the thing I'm gonna do, because like that makes me feel in control, because I can take it beat by beat. Because that's the other thing is like I have ADD, and one of the things that was very overwhelming for me about it of growing up was like this feeling of like, there's just so much. I'm dealing, like, I was taking in so much input. A lot of people think ADD means like you don't pay attention. It's not the case. That can be part of it. But really, for me, it was just like I couldn't focus on one thing at a time. I was paying attention to everything at once.
Right.
And like taking in all this information and all this stuff, and a very overactive imagination. And so like I would have all this just like input, and like I couldn't process it because it all seemed like so much. But if I broke it down into like individual pieces, I could do it. So like in college, when I needed to study, I would turn on the TV and like play a movie and play music, and like then I could read.
Then you could focus.
Because like those parts of my brain were distracted by other things, and then my brain was like, we can read now. It's like, thank you.
See, yeah, Dave wants a go bag, and I'm really more of the if I could just have a cyanide capsule, I'm good.
No.
See, my goal, I want to win. I look at the apocalypse like a thing I can win. I don't think forever, but more so than most people is my goal. You know, I just want to extend my time further than other people.
I realize that's not going to happen because I watch Doomsday Preppers, and those people, they're so much more committed.
But I feel like they're not as creative. That's the difference. Is I feel like I'm a little committed, but very creative, because that's one of the things in technical theater. There were people who were far more trained than I was, and they knew how to like actually build the things I was trying to build.
Yeah,
but like, I was creative enough that I figured out other ways to do it better knowing I was doing it wrong.
You could problem solve circles.
Yeah. And like I worked with this dude who was like my second. He was my assistant technical director. And like he I went to college for acting and, like, worked in the shop while I was, like, getting my acting degree.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm good, you know, at building. I'm good at construction. And so, like, I ended up getting that job. But it's not what I was specifically trained for. This dude was, like, trained for it. And he would sit there and, like, list all these things. I'm like, yeah, that's great. We don't have $5,000 to do that. So, like, we can't make a turntable that way. So I'm going to make it like this. And he was like, oh, yeah, that works. And it's like, we made it for, like, $100. And it worked great. So, like, that's my apocalypse skill is, like, I'm going to make do with what I've got. And it'll be better, like... I'll be the guy who figures out plumbing with, like, bamboo, and, like, while the mechanical engineer's going, but we need, like, aluminum, and we're like, yeah, we don't have copper, Dave. We need to... I'm not yelling at you, Dave. I was looking at a fictional Dave, and it was just the name that popped into my head. I don't know why I got mad at you, Dave. I apologize. It's
cool. All I know how to do is cook things, so...
That's a huge skill.
My treats are going to endear me to the other survivors.
I talk about on the show all the time that, like, if you ever run across... like a renegade gang, the two fastest ways to ingratiate yourself is cooking and humor.
Yeah.
And like those two, because like the image I always have in my head of the humor one is just someone going, this guy's all right. And like, that's what I'm always like, that's my angle of like, everybody's kind of grumbling at me at first. And then like, I do a pratfall, I guess. And they're like, you know what? Hey, this guy's all right.
You do the tequila dance.
Yeah. Like it's always Pee Wee's Big Adventure. That's what I always think of in that scenario. That is the, like, that's what I'm going to do. Because my cooking's okay, but unless I can bake, like, that's the only cooking skill I'm any good at. But if they're like, we need you to, like, dress and clean this animal, I'm like, oh, no, thank you. No.
How long have you been in L.A.? Because I feel like you just got here, but it's probably been years.
About 2 years, a little less. It feels far shorter.
And did you, you know, people move here and either immediately love it or, like, Dave had complained so much for the first 2 years that we lived here that he got a book out of it. So
nice.
How was your transition?
You know, here's the thing. So honest answer is we lived in Cincinnati. My wife and I lived in Cincinnati for 5 years. Yeah. I don't know. I'm really bad at gauging time. Like, I'm so bad. And it fluctuates between me saying like 7, 6, 5. I think it was 5. And I know it's 2 since I've been here. We lived there for 5 years, and my complaint about Cincinnati was always like, it's good. It's a good city, but no one's ever going to argue it's like the greatest city in the world.
Right.
But everybody has like their favorite restaurant, or you love the Reds, or you love the Bengals, or you love the theater. There's a lot of great theater in Cincinnati. But it was not, it didn't have any potential. There was no upward, like, what was I going to do?
You weren't going to take Cincinnati.
So then, I was feeling very frustrated and very stagnant. And so we moved here because the podcasting was really taking off, and it was enough that, like, we could afford to live in Los Angeles just based off barely based off of podcasting income.
Right.
And so we moved here, and very quickly, my friend Clint Wilson asked me about Los Angeles, and I compared it to like a restaurant where like the food is the greatest, and you can't find it anywhere else. But, like, the service is terrible, and there's a huge wait, and the chairs are uncomfortable, and, like, you can never find parking. But the food is amazing. And, like, that's the thing of, like, there's – if you want to be doing the things that are being done in Los Angeles, you would be dumb to be anywhere else. Right. So, like, if you want to be working in movies and you're living in, like, Tucson – you should do whatever it takes, because you might be able to eke out, like, a film career in Tucson – but you come to Los Angeles and just everybody's doing something. And like, especially if you're just doing it for the love of the thing and you don't need the money and you just want to be working on projects, everybody's doing a project all the time, whether it's YouTube videos or whatever. So moving here and getting to like guest on people's podcasts, be around a really, I love the energy of Los Angeles in a way that I think most people do not because I love how fakey nice everyone is. I love it. And especially being a person who does podcasting professionally, everyone at a party is very interested in me. They pretend to be, at least, and I love it. Because the thing that I do is a very new career path.
Sure, yeah.
And so everyone's very interested to find out how they could be doing it and making money doing the thing that I'm making money doing.
Right.
And so I get asked a lot of questions about myself. I get to talk about myself a lot at parties. It's great. I love myself. And, like, I talk to my friends who prefer New York to L.A. I'm like, that's a thing they hate. And I'm like, yeah, but in New York, no one's even pretending to be nice. Like, at least here, everyone's pretending to be nice and be interested. And that was the other thing that I really loved about L.A. right off the bat was, like, when I said, I have an idea for a thing. People go, okay, tell me. I am interested because maybe your idea for a thing turns into a thing I can do. And now it's my thing, too. And now we're both famous based off of your thing. but it so very quickly became clear to us that, like, I didn't want to be working in movies. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be doing podcasts. When I moved here, I went from one podcast to seven very quickly.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, this is what I want to be doing full time. It's just this. And I don't want to audition for stuff. I don't want to be in things. I just want the podcast.
Right.
And so then we very quickly realized, like, okay, so we're paying a lot of money for rent a month and bills a month and food a month here in Los Angeles so that I can work from home and I'm not auditioning for anything and not collab. Like, and so now we're moving back to Cincinnati because I realized that, like, as a home base, it's such a good choice. Like, I can get so much house for so little money comparatively in Cincinnati and then fly and travel. And, like, it really came from making a lot of friends that are in Los Angeles all the time but don't live here. And it's like, oh, yeah, I could just be doing that.
Right.
Why wasn't I doing that? I could fly in and guest in people's podcasts and do live shows and go to events and then go home to Cincinnati where it takes 10 minutes to drive everywhere. Why aren't I doing that? And that is by no means to, like, begrudge anybody who's like, but I can only be doing what I'm doing in Los Angeles. Like, yeah, then you should definitely I could do what I do from anywhere.
Yeah.
I don't need to be here. So I still love the energy of it. I look forward to visiting a lot.
Mm.
But I was walking my dog the other day and had this overwhelming feeling of, like, oh, you know what? I think I have been a metaphorical knot for the last 2 years since I got here. Just whether it's from driving or, like, just feeling like something bad was about to happen all the time in Los Angeles, that I'm like, I can just at the very prospect of moving back to Cincinnati, feel the knot start to unwind a little bit, that I'm like, oh, that's going to be great. It's going to feel like living in a vacation to, like, own a house and, like, not have traffic everywhere. It's going to be great.
Well, see, you've at least licked the whole thing of how to do podcasts from multiple locations. As an idiot myself, I have not ever nailed, like, how Skype works and how you edit things together. So pretty much every podcast guest we've ever had is sitting in the chair you're in.
I tell you what, the McRoy family is very singular in that we are pioneers in the world of remote podcasting. And even then, like, we've been doing my brother and me, I think we're under six years. And still, like, the other day I was like, yeah, I can't get Skype to work. And we had to like call each other on our cell phones and do it through cell phones because we couldn't get the Skype to work. The nice thing is we each record our own audio track remotely.
Right.
So, like, it sounds however we sound in the room and you don't worry about sounding like you're on a cell phone. And then we just all, like, cut them together.
No, I've done it for other people. Like, I'll tape my end and I'll send them the file and they'll magically make it sound like a decent thing. But
yeah.
It's no idea.
It's not the way to do it at all. We do it really bad. It's stupid. The way that we do it, when we started, it was Justin and Griffin and I were all in Huntington, and then Griffin and I were moving to Cincinnati, and Justin was like, at that point, Justin and Griffin were doing the Joystick podcast for the video game website they work for, Joystick. They're video game journalists. And Justin was like, oh, we should do a podcast so that we have an excuse to talk to each other, like, once a week. And we're like, yeah, that sounds great. So then we started doing the show, and even though Griffin and I were living in the same apartment, when it was time to record, we'd go into our separate bedrooms and, like, record on our separate computers, because that's how Justin and Griffin and all their people on the Joystick podcast recorded. Like, Justin and Griffin were both in Huntington, but they were recording in separate houses for the Joystick podcast. Like, we had no idea you were supposed to record a podcast in the same room until it was, like, a year in. And, like, we told somebody, like, at that point, Griffin was in Chicago and I was in Cincinnati and Justin was in Huntington. And everybody was like, oh, but then how do you record? And we're like, in different places? And they're like, what? Are you crazy? And, like, we didn't know that we weren't supposed to do that.
There's nothing like not knowing you're not supposed to do something to make you make something
work. And I'm so, I think that the McElroys are so lucky to be where we are at all at this point, because in the beginning days, the first like 10 episodes of My Brother and Me, audio quality wise, are so bad.
Fascinating.
Oh, please. We were coming through one ear for the first like 10 episodes.
And the fact that people like still were like, I'm going to keep giving you a shot, makes me feel very lucky.
It blows my mind that we retained any people listening to us for the first 6 months.
Yeah.
Because we were so inept. We've been doing this 5 years. I still don't know what any of this means. I'm now pointing to the equipment and wires, and he does everything, and I just show up and make the muffins.
Sometimes you just gotta make the muffins. I've now since I do it full time, and I do 6 days a week, 27 episodes a month, 40-50 hours a week of podcasting. I think about it a lot. And I've become very obsessed with recording equipment and finding the best podcasting setup for a home recording studio, and I've gotten a little bit obsessive about it. My wife does not like how quickly I cycle through microphones, and I'm like, no, I can hear it. This one's bad. I can hear a buzz. And she's like, you just bought microphones like 2 months ago. I'm like, yeah, but like these, they have gold-plated cables. She's like, yeah, you didn't. Please don't. I'm like, but I want to figure it out. I want to fix it. I want to solve it.
Ours are like tin cans. So, that you are not a film critic. However, you are a media person and also an actor, so you are qualified to review films.
Oh, thank you. Is that all it takes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
you talk about everything. I mean, sheesh.
Well, I mean, can I give you my broad thesis I've been working on lately of critics and film critics? And I have immense amount of respect for film critics, especially in this day and age of the internet, because I've been crusading for the last couple of weeks now about Ghostbusters, because I love it very much. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a great movie. I had a lot of fun, and I loved it very much. And so I've really been trying to analyze this, like, the scenario that brought us to where we are with the 2016 Ghostbusters. And my thesis idea, my hypothesis that I've been working on, is this idea of one of the greatest things about the internet is it has opened up and provided so many different avenues for people to voice their opinions, specifically like Twitter and Facebook.
Sure.
That everybody is now feeling about critics what everyone has always felt about actors, which is that feeling of like, I can get up on stage and say some words.
My kid could paint
this that. Isn't hard. And it's just like, yeah, listen, anybody can complain about a movie. Anybody can like say, I didn't like that movie, or I loved it. There's an art form to like very delicately like phrasing your opinions, and I've also seen this in video game reviewing. My brothers do that still, and I think that there's this thing of like people are like, I play video games and I have opinions, why should I listen to your opinions? Right. It's like, oh man, it must be so hard to be a critic these days, because everyone feels like they're a critic, and I think people are starting to go like, well, why should I listen to your opinion? I've got opinions. And it's like, because they're like, they know what they have informed opinions, and your opinion is based off of that one game you played, where my brothers play 80 games a month, you know what I mean? And like, they talk to people about it. But I, not to get on a soapbox about video game journalism, but like that idea of everybody now feels like every opinion is on the same level.
Yeah.
And so then, like, when you say, so for example, I'm a big fan of Ghostbusters, and I have zero interest in seeing Suicide Squad. And I said on the show, like, in Terabang, I was talking about this, and I said, like, I have zero interest in seeing it. If you want to go see it, I'm not going to tell you not to. I just don't understand why people want to go see it. There's nothing about, and I love comic books, I love superhero movies, and I love, like, popcorn action summer flicks. I was like, but there's nothing about anything I've read or the trailers I've seen or anything that make me want to go see it. And people got, like, mad at me.
They're angry.
For saying that. I was like, no, you can't, like, it's okay that I don't want to see it. I'm not trying to get it removed from theater so you can't see it. Yeah. But then people then, like, somebody was like, what's the difference between that, how you feel about Suicide Squad, and all these people talking about Ghostbusters that makes you so mad? I was like, oh, that's the difference. Like, if you were like, I liked Suicide Squad, I'd be like, okay. But I said I liked Ghostbusters on Twitter and got a flood of people telling me I was stupid. And it's like, that's the difference? So I have many opinions about about movies. I will in no way claim to have practiced the art of delivering them in a good way. And that's my preface to your audience, that if I say a thing, you're like, I completely disagree with that. Like, cool, cool, man. Good. Because my opinions are my own and I'm not telling you to share them with me.
So this blows my mind. 8 films came out this week. Well, more than 8, honestly. Yeah. More than 8 films came out
8
this week.
8 that we saw.
But 8 that we have either both seen or one of us has at least seen. We are not talking about all 8 of those movies today because there's just not enough time.
So let me
Here's what is out.
Let me knock these two off the list because I talked about both of them in the post Carlo Vivari Film Festival episode. So if you want to hear me talk about Anthropoid,
yes.
Or you want to hear me talk
which is about an alien.
Right? That's what I thought it was. And we were like, we're talking about. I was like, okay, Anthropoid. I have zero interest.
An alien that fights Hitler.
Yeah.
Okay.
A terrible title for
Space Monsters.
For a World War II
versus
movie
Hitler.
About the Czech resistance. And then Bloodfather, the Mel Gibson movie that is very grindhousey and, in fact, is opening at drive-ins in Southern California.
Really?
It kills me that we don't have time to go out to.
I know. I still want to go to the Mission Tiki to see Bloodfather at the Mission Tiki.
That's awesome.
Before you leave Los Angeles, sir, you have to go to the Mission Tiki. It's in Montclair, California. It's about a 45-minute drive east of here.
Well, I have 12 days to make that happen, so we'll see what I can do. Okay.
Well, maybe not then. But
it's a lovely place.
On one of your many future
visits. Yes, I will visit back, especially in the winter.
Okay, well, it's in the winter, you can still do the drive-in here.
Yes.
It's temperate. Anyway, so they're showing Bloodfather. Love that movie, but I talked about it in the Carlo Vivari episode, so you can go back and look at that.
And I'll be seeing it, and Dave is going to catch up. We'll revisit that one.
It's going to be available streaming on the 26th, so maybe we'll circle back and talk about it then.
There's also Little Men finally has opened in Los Angeles. I did not yet see that one, but I will.
Okay.
For those of you who are excited about The Fight Within. We went to that yesterday. That's not for today either. That's for next week. Just so you know,
that is the
Christian mixed martial arts film.
Cool, cool.
Yeah.
Great.
And the people who think you can get up and say words and be an actor, they all are in this movie.
Great.
And apparently their lighting director feels the same
way. So what you're saying is, it was awesome. 10 out of 10.
Yeah. Okay. It was shot in Tuscaloosa.
Uh-huh.
In semi-shadow.
At someone's church.
Cool, cool.
And we were nearly alone in the theater yesterday.
Mm. We had to drive all the way to Norwalk to see it.
Great.
That's next week as well, and maybe even Hell or High Water.
Depending.
Because we got Pete's Dragon.
The big movies this week.
We got
Sausage Party.
Sausage Party, and we got Flo Fo J.
Right.
Let me ask you guys a question. Movie, actually.
Yeah.
Did this feel like a bit of a chaff week in general? As far like I was looking at the other movies that have come out in the last like 3 weeks, and like it feels like Suicide Squad was very hyped and big, and you had like Star Trek Beyond. What was that 2 weeks ago?
Right, and Ghostbusters the week before that.
And I feel like this week was like.
Do you know about the whole August?
No, that's what I'm asking about.
Explain that.
Well, okay. Basically, August is considered
kind of
a dead zone for the most part. Sometimes you'll get like maybe one big action movie at the very beginning of the month. It's become a place to launch.
It's become Seth Rogen's favorite.
I was going to say, it's become a place to launch R-rated comedies. Ever since The 40-Year-Old Virgin or so. Like, this has been the kind of late summer Apatow slot. But the big sort of summer movies, as we think of like giant summer movies, is mostly over at this point.
Is that just because everyone's like going back to school, going back to work, and so they're trying to get them like in? Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense because I was looking at this week and I was like, all of these movies look good, but there's not one of them that's just like, oh, that's going to run away with it this week. Right. That's going to be the hit.
And in years past, also, I think August was a time where those movies could kind of keep making money, but this summer they stacked up so many opposite against each other, or like 1 week after another week.
Yep.
You know, there was a really good Forbes piece about how, you know, there was a big drop-off for second weekend of Ghostbusters because they opened Star Trek Beyond. And there was a big Star Trek drop-off because of Jason Bourne. And then a big Bourne drop-off because of Suicide Squad. Like, I forget what I'm getting those in the right order. But basically the idea of give them a second weekend to breathe, you know. And they just weren't doing that this year.
Okay, so you saw Pete's Dragon.
I did.
Tell them what it's about, Alonzo.
Okay, so it's...
there's this dragon, right?
It is a remake in name only, yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah. It's not... I don't remember much about the first one. I was a child when I saw it, and it...
Well, your beloved Shelley Winters is in it.
I know, but all I remember about it is that bad Helen Reddy song.
Candle on the Water is not a bad song.
It's a completely out of context bad song for that movie. Like, I remember very clearly being a kid and watching that movie and getting that song, like, what is this? This doesn't fit here. Why am I... What?
Yeah, unlike the Jungle Book remake this year, where they kind of felt like they had to wedge in a couple of those numbers, like no singing at all. Well, there is a song, but it's actually a new song that Will Oldham co-wrote.
Yes.
And there's no lighthouse. It's all set in a forest. And
it's not period. It's not period. In now times.
Well, is it? Wait, is it?
Or is it the 70s?
Is it? Or is it the 80s? Or is it that, one's got a cell phone? Yeah, none of the music's contemporary.
It's one of those movies where, like, they've only got landlines and there's no computers. But also they're in the middle of the woods, so maybe they wouldn't.
What it is it's just like any script, any theater script, where it just says present as like the time period. Yeah. And it's like, okay, but that's like, you wrote it in 1950. Yeah, so like Neil Simon wrote his in the present.
Here's what I was thinking as I watched it. I assumed it was now, but I assumed it was the now of like rustic, rough-hewn woodland people who don't care so much about that new technology.
You were going to say newfangled, weren't you?
No. And they... new. I'm just new. I know about things that are new. I live now. But the... Like people who voluntarily don't have Facebook.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly what they were going for. Yeah. Of just like, you know, the simpler people. And which, like, growing up in West Virginia, I looked at them like, yeah, like, bite me. Like, that idea of, like, the sheriff doesn't have a cell phone that he can call Grace on her cell phone. Yeah. Like, they all work for the Forestry Service and the sheriff. Right. Like, they don't have cell phones to call each other. They're calling each other.
Cars? Weren't they like
they were all like 60s, 70s, 80s trucks.
Yeah, I guess they were. The movie opens, because it's a Disney film, it opens with the death of Pete's parents.
What? Yeah. In a
pretty tough scene.
Yeah. Brutal. Imagine.
It's one of those inside the car accidents.
I hate those. Every time I see someone in a car, in any film now, I think, okay, well, here comes the car accident.
I had a lot of big problems with it, but one of them was like some movies, maybe you guys know this, trust their audience to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
And this movie just filled in all the blanks for you. Yeah, and I was like, you could have shown me them like turning around thing, like cut to upside down car, but instead you showed me like a 5-year-old boy flipping. I was in the theater, so I went at 9 a.m. this morning to the Grove, and I was in a theater, and it was like me and like 4 or 5, it looked like all dads and daughters, or like some combination of parent and kid.
Yeah,
young kid, like I would say 6 to 10 were the age range I was seeing at 9 a.m. And that scene started off, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, there are children. This is a kid's movie. And there were a lot of really horrifying things right at the beginning.
Right.
Like, my wife asked me to, like, when she was like, when you go see it, let me know what you think. Because, like, she loves, you know, any kind of, like, Disney old school movie. She was like, yeah, I don't like things that, like, attempt to ruin my memories of, like, childhood movies.
Yeah.
Not like Ghostbusters 2016 drama, but like she loves, you know, Sword in the Stone. If they remade Sword in the Stone, like, no, that's my...
I think they're gonna, actually, but not that the original Pete's Dragon was all that great. Like,
no, but it was whimsy. It was silly, and it was that live action plus animated Disney thing that, like, where you had like the penguins and Mary Poppins. Yeah, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. That was like their like trademark for a long time that I loved. And so I was like, yeah, Pete's Dragon, whimsy.
Even as a kid, I was kind of bored by the original Pete's Dragon. But yeah, you're right. It's a different tack.
I would say, like, this is the dark, gritty reboot of Pete's Dragon that no one's been asking for.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. So Pete is orphaned in this car accident, but he is in the woods before a pack of wolves can eat him. He is rescued by this giant dragon, a green, fuzzy dragon, whom he dubs Elliot. And he lives with Elliot in the woods as a feral child for, like, 6 years?
Yeah, something like that.
And
then
we cut ahead to...
And I had so many detailed questions for that moment, but then each time I came up with an idea of like, who's feeding this child?
Yeah,
what,
right.
What's happening? What?
Like, and then I Elliot thought, okay, doesn't well, talk to
Elliot's
him.
Elliot's doing it. I guess Elliot's giving him berries or whatever.
But see, and, that's the difference between yeah. like the old movie and this one is when you start that he's just been living with Elliot, they've been yeah. making it right, I don't question it. But yeah. when you show me that he's five and he's been with him for 6 years, I'm like, well, now I have to ask questions because you made me ask questions. Like, did Elliot teach him what mushrooms he could eat? Did Elliot does Elliot kill deer for him to eat? Like, what?
and then cook it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
I think because he's a magic dragon, maybe that he can do a lot of things that are magic.
How did the kid keep from freezing to death in the middle of the winter?
Well, that I felt was very explained because Elliot is very sheltery of him and free.
No, that's true. I definitely thought that, but like, did they just like hibernate? Because like, he was in rags.
Right.
Like, he's not going out during when it's snowing. And they're in like, it looks like it's going to be some more like Portland.
The Pacific Northwest somewhere.
Not like downtown Portland, mind you, but like that area. Oregon.
Yeah, it was
very smart of them actually to make him a plush, hairy dragon. Because that boy, the parks, they're going to have those Elliot dolls.
Oh, yeah. But I will actually say too that like, I couldn't get away from the fact that I actually found Elliot a little horrifying.
Really?
Yeah, not like he was very dog-like. They make him very dog-like, and I think that is very lovable. But like, I kept comparing him to the old Elliot of like where he was animated and silly looking, maybe imaginary. Who knew? But he's silly. Right. This was like too real. I didn't like it.
I cried. This movie totally worked for me.
I was so ready to, and I didn't.
It's E.T. It is so E.T. It is so like a Lassie movie.
I was crying at the previews. I was ready to cry. It was 9 a.m. I'm ready to cry. I was in it. I was warming up the tear ducts. And no.
I even went with a friend of ours who calls himself Dead Inside, and he cried. I think he said it was the first time that we both cried at a movie.
I know this person, and he's a marshmallow.
Yeah. Anyway, so but for me it worked, and I everything y'all are saying I can't like actively disagree with. And had I thought more about like the logistics of how is this kid staying alive for 6 years in the woods, you're right, it doesn't answer a lot of that. But I think the kid, what is his name?
Oaks Fegley.
Thank you. I think he's really good. The Una Lawrence, I think, is a really terrific young actress.
And that's Natalie. They were both great. Like,
she was in Bad Moms and Southpaw last year. Best thing I've seen Bryce Dallas Howard in, I want to say.
Yeah,
in a while.
You know, and playing the opposite of her Jurassic World character,
Pilar can find her keys to get in.
She got it. I don't know. I liked the characters. I liked the idea of both Elliot and Pete sort of needing a family and not having one.
That I liked.
I don't know. It worked, but you know, I think it might have. Maybe I just got sucker punched by
it. The two biggest issues that I had. One. So this movie fell into a writing problem that I think happens way too often in movies, which is the conflict is completely manufactured, and like it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy conflict where
that's Suicide Squad,
right? Where the conflict of this, so like I don't know how much I can give away in this, but the conflict in this is totally created by characters reacting to Elliot. Whereas in the original one, Elliot, like the big swelling moment is like her husband or whatever fiance is out at sea, and Elliot like helps rescue him, and like that's the big swelling thing.
Yeah.
The entire conflict of this movie is like, had they never interacted with Elliot, would have never happened, which was weird to me because I felt like it was building to this like deforestation, brother against brother conflict, but none of that came to pass, and it was completely like, okay, there were no stakes until the stakes were made by them and then also dissipated by them. There was no outside force acting upon this at all. If everyone had just been cool, none of it would have happened. And I also felt like Carl Urban and
Wes Bentley,
there's a version of this script where they are one person and the conflict is between Bryce Dallas Howard and her fiance, where he wants to do it, and someone's, I guarantee, I believe that this is true.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's true, but I believe it, that someone said, I don't know. I think we've made the fiance too unlikable.
Yeah.
How about we give him a brother? Because neither one of them are that interesting separately.
No, they're not.
Especially Wes Bentley. He does nothing in this movie.
Except just be kind.
Yeah. And even that is just, he's so reactionary to everything. Like, he's the guy who comes in and hugs someone after they've been saved from something. That's what he does in the movie. He does not exert any force upon the movie whatsoever. And Carl Urban's character seems like they were going, he's the bad guy? Yeah. But he's not really. Like, I think that all of his behavior is fairly justified.
He gets badder as it moves along.
Right.
Like, the more people react to him being a bad guy, the more he thinks,
I'll show you.
Oh, yeah? I'll show you bad. I got more bad to do.
Yeah. Whereas, like, I felt like, not to keep harping on it compared to the original movie, but I felt like there were a lot of moments in the original where you had, like, the snake oil salesman who wanted to capture the dragon to use parts of the dragon to, like, make these medicines. And then he was like, we can use him as a sideshow thing. And it was, like, a whimsical bad guy force that was, like, more of, like, a Harlequin, like, oh, he's a trickster and he's kind of messing things up, but he's not evil. Like, he's not...
But you've also got, like, Shelley Winters saying, like, that she owns the kid, I got a bill of sale and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's a little dark, too, I think. I don't know. I can't argue with a lot of the meat of what you're saying. All I can say is that it didn't bother me, and that I did just sort of get sort of swept into the human moments of the kids, of Elliot, or sorry, of Pete, and this sort of new kind of family that's going to be created for him, his relationship with Elliot, which, again, you know, like, little kid playing opposite a tennis ball is, you know, it's still very moving.
He did great. I was more moved by this as a pet owner than as a future parent, where I thought I would be moved as a future parent. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm about to have a kid, and especially in that first moment with the family and the car accident. And that, but like, really, as I was watching, I was like, I love my dog. I miss my dog. I wish my dog was here.
So this is David Lowery's big breakthrough. He did an indie film a couple years ago called Ain't Them Body Saints. He did the score for Upstream Color, so he sort of runs with that pack of, like, Austin film guys. But this is, you know, it's that thing where if you're a guy who has a well-received Sundance movie, even if it doesn't make any money, some studio will hand you the keys. And if you're a woman, maybe you'll get to direct HBO episodic. Yeah. You know. So this is his sort of big breakthrough thing. And I think there is a certain indie touch to it in the sort of the timelessness that we talked about, as far as the when is this thing even set. And the fact that for a, you know, if you want to categorize this with, like, you know, Maleficent and other sort of Disney new live action versions of things, it feels a lot more grounded and human to me.
Yeah, very much so. And I also would be remiss if I did not compliment. I thought Robert Redford did great.
Oh, yeah.
They very clearly shot him out in like 2 days, but he did. He did wonderfully. And I agree with you. I think it is a very human version of it. And I think, honestly, that's what I disliked about it, because I wanted whimsy and silly. And like, you mentioned the new Jungle Book redoing, where I had kind of the same issue about that. I was like, oh, showing me a real kid makes me very scared. Whereas like a cartoon Mowgli didn't bother me at all, that he's hanging out with bears and stuff. Right. Sure.
If this movie hadn't been called Pete's Dragon, would you?
I would have liked it way more.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that was it. It's like, I thought about that. And like as I was watching the credits, so I was like, you could have called this anything else and like renamed Pete, and it would have been a fine movie, but there was not enough in it that was Pete's Dragon to me that was like, of course this is Pete's Dragon. Of course. How could you call this anything else?
What I liked about it, honestly, as I watched it, I continuously thought about that 70s kid movie, The Wilderness Family.
Oh, yeah, where the red fern grows, that kind of genre.
There's this 70s quality to it. Not in the 70s that we think of, the golden age of filmmaking in the 70s, all these paranoid whatever. I'm thinking more along like
kids movies
of the 70s, and specifically like the family in our town who raised worms to eat.
Wait, is that real?
They were hippies. Yeah.
Nice.
They were hippies, and they were like, alternative protein. And their kids were all, you know, wearing homemade dresses and stuff. That's how this all felt to me.
Yes.
And the more I kept hearing the Will Oldham song, the more I thought, this is like Old Joy, but for children, you know, about like, it's the Kelly Reichardt film about, you know, friendship, and Will Oldham is in the film. But because Will Oldham is tight with David Lowery and got himself a nice paycheck with this song for the soundtrack. That's great. But what I liked about the film was that it had this very low-key stoner's approach to, well, everything.
Yes.
And so even though the stakes didn't feel super high, it seemed to me to be a movie about, even less at times, about the relationship between the kid and the dragon and the bad people who wanted to subdue the dragon, but more about the fate of this child and who was going to get custody of him.
Yeah.
And so you have Bryce Dallas Howard, who you mentioned as being really good in the film, and I agree with you. She was so maternal and so sweet and so gentle that I thought, if I was this little kid, you know, I would like maybe to spend weekends with the dragon and get a nice meal.
Yeah.
Get a nice meal from this nice mommy lady who wants to.
Who he is seems super
in.
On board with right away. The first time he sees her, he's mesmerized by her.
Well, he has literally seen no human being since his parents died.
And so but what I thought was radical about the film was the idea that all the adults, Bryce Dallas Howard, Wes Bentley, were seemed to be at least 50% on board with the idea that, well, you know, we might just need to let him go off and live in the woods with the dragon.
Yeah, right.
Like, it'll be okay if he does
that. She has that moment where she rolls up and there's, like, the Child Protective Services card, and she's like, I don't know. No, it's like, wait, hold on. What movie is this? Because you're right, because in any other movie, like, he would have to escape from that and run away. Yeah. But Bryce Dallas Howard is like, you know what?
Maybe.
Let's do it.
Maybe, and it's he's a nature boy. He's going to go off and live in a loincloth with the dragon in the woods.
Yeah.
It's going to be fine.
But you're right, though. There was a point where I thought, we're getting like an eco-fable here with all the logging and stuff.
It touched on that, but
it's
not very
much. Thing. I think, in general, the movie I loved in this movie was the movie it kept hinting at.
Yeah.
Where, like, Robert Redford's talking about, like, no one ever believed me, and they, like, thought I was crazy. And I was like, I don't see any of that. You don't show that. You just have him tell me people treated him like that. And it's like, I've caught the Millhaven Dragon. It's like, I don't see anybody. Like, there's no, like, show me a scene in the Millhaven Dragon Museum and where it's a big tourist draw. Like, there was all this stuff that they talked about. Yeah, and, like, the Child Protective Services battle where it's like, that's an interesting part. Nope. Okay, cool. Great. That didn't happen.
I think they didn't want to make him, you know, Randy Quaid in the first Independence
Day.
And I was actually glad when they didn't go down the Child Protective Services path, because I thought, we know where that's going to go. And so I was happy they skipped it entirely. And of course, now I just think that it's going to be like Stranger Things, where it's going to be somebody else who's going to shoot everyone. So.
Yeah. Right. I did like the movie. I did not hate it.
Okay.
I want to make that clear.
You're allowed to hate it.
I felt like I liked it for the movie I thought it could have been, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Where, like, the scene of him, like, running through town, and he's, like, running over a school bus, and all. I thought, like, this is going to turn into a whole town turns out to support the kid. No. Like, there were just so many things where I was like, I see what direction. And it wasn't, like, the kind of thing where sometimes you think you know what direction a movie's going, and then it zigs, and you're like, I never would have seen it. This was more like, last night, my friend Tybee was talking about seeing a movie, and she described it as, like, walking down a hallway, and all these doors labeled, like, character has a realization. Character changes. Right. Character grows. And, like, someone's leading you down the hallway, and you start to turn towards every door, and they're like, no, come on. And then you get down to the end of the hallway, and, like, and that's the end of the tour. And that's what I felt like watching this movie, where, like, I kept seeing very interesting hallways we could turn down. Mm. And then we just got to the end. And like I said, it filled in so many blanks that I could have done on my own and that kids can do because they're not dumb. And I thought that this movie in general treated kids a little bit like they're dumb. Like, the very end of the movie could have been I will not say what happened.
You could kill the voiceover for sure.
Yeah. But like, I mean, like the final like 3 seconds of the movie, like the shot, I could have filled that in my imagination if you just gave me some kind of like just seeing the kid's face react to a thing and we all go like, magic. This is the magic they were talking about. I feel the magic, right? But instead they were like, no, here, just see it. Like, you don't have to imagine anything. I'll just give it to you.
So, let's move to Sausage Party.
Oh, why not?
This one I haven't seen, so I'll talk way less.
Oh, you could say whatever you want
I'm going to have lots of questions.
Pretend you've seen it.
It is the hit of the weekend.
It's,
is it really?
It even beat out Suicide Squad, yeah.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah, it surprised
I didn't know
people.
About that.
They did not expect that.
Well, it's about a bunch of food in a supermarket, which has already been a movie.
Yes, a terrible, terrible film called Food Fight.
Food Fight.
Yes. We did on the Flophouse.
Yes.
And
which I kind of almost suggest that people see because it's staggeringly terrible and misguided.
Yeah.
You can't believe.
Those are my favorite kind of movies, by the way.
Yeah. Then top of the list, this one.
If you walk out of Sausage Party and think that was just whatever, go see Food Fight. Go watch Food Fight. It's on YouTube or whatever, and you'll understand the majesty and brilliance of Sausage Party by comparison.
Well, by comparison, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me all about it. I'm super curious. I'm your audience surrogate.
Seth Rogen is a hot dog, and Kristen Wiig is a bun, and they live on the shelf in their respective packs.
Although hot dogs are refrigerated. Usually.
They have these are those kind that you can get that are at room temperature.
You know, the healthy ones.
Yeah.
Extra so, nitrates.
They're cured.
So they have a crush on each other. And they want to be both purchased at the same time so that they can leave the supermarket together and go off to what they know as the great beyond.
Yes.
They don't know what exists outside the supermarket. They think it's essentially heaven.
Yeah.
And
so every day when the sun rises, all the food in the grocery store sings this song thanking the Lord for the great beyond and how they can't wait to get there and how the gods will treat them wonderfully for the rest of their
lives. Is it very saccharine and very like...
A little bit. Alan Menken co-wrote it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So, and what happens is that a bottle of honey mustard that is voiced by Danny McBride gets returned to the store.
And he has a story to tell.
And he knows of the horrors of what actually goes on in the Great Beyond.
You get it.
But he is silenced by this Firewater whiskey, which is an Indian, a Native American, voiced by Bill Hader. This movie thinks it's making fun of ethnic stereotypes in food packaging, but it's indulging in just as many of them.
I believe, well, okay, we'll digress here from the plot for a moment.
Yes.
I believe that the film is in good faith simultaneously indulging and subverting those all the stereotypes, because they're based on ethnicity, they're based on race, they're based on sexual orientation. You know, all the fruit is gay. The taco is a lesbian, voiced by Salma Hayek.
Yeah, okay. See, if you're gonna have a Mexican lesbian taco, then hire Salma Hayek.
Yes.
But if you're gonna have a sort of platitude spouting, you know, Indian
chief, I understand,
or a staggeringly drunk Mexican tequila bottle,
I get it.
They're both Bill Hader.
No, I know. And that's a problem. But I think the film is pretty smart in its upending of these ideas.
There's an effort.
Casting or not.
It works.
Yeah, there's if you are, easily upset, this might not be the film for you.
It seems like from all the previews and everything I've seen about it, that they're kind of leaning into that.
Yeah.
This kind of
hey,
this movie's offensive. Deal with that.
Right.
Which is
that element going on.
Which I'm fine with. I love offensive material as long as it's funny offensive material.
Yeah.
I did not laugh
they didn't
nearly
earn it.
Enough.
Okay.
That's where it comes down.
This is no South Park Bigger, Longer, Longer.
Okay, and just to give a little bit of my credentials for asking about all this, my favorite movie in the world is Blazing Saddles, which I feel like does all of the things we're talking about of subverting this stuff masterfully. So, like, it can be done, and I've seen it done in a non-offensive way.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
This is not that.
Okay.
It's
trying to be that? It's making an effort
I think
at
it's
that?
Sometimes successful and sometimes not successful.
Okay.
I don't think it's an entire disaster on those terms. I think it's...
It's not awful, but I laughed so few times. Like, I laughed on a par with as many times as I laughed at Nine Lives.
Okay.
There's a really brilliantly funny scene early on that's sort of like where they kind of recreate the opening of Saving Private Ryan, and there's a wildly outrageous ending. And both of those moments I think really worked for me, and I laughed a few times every so often. I usually laughed at what you hated most in the movie, which is all the food puns. Because that
it does seem like that's what they promised with the movie, right?
The food puns were fine. There were, you know, it was, after a while, listening to another food pun, I just thought, well, there's another food pun.
But I just, Yeah, I thought there was a lot of promise here. It's funny, Christy reminded me on What the Flick, this show I do on YouTube, we did a little extra segment early on for subscribers to the Young Turks, and we all talked about what summer movie are you most looking forward to. And I actually said Sausage Party, because the early screenings at South by Southwest, everybody just raved about it and said it was the funniest movie ever and blah, blah, blah. I love all the people involved. I think Rogen and Goldberg have made a lot of really good movies.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was shocked at how not laughing I was.
Do you think, are you the audience for the movie? Because I could definitely, like, that's kind of been my take watching the preview.
I believe I am.
That's been my take watching the previews, where I was like, yeah. I'm not the audience for this, but I know that that audience exists.
I would like to think that I am. I mean, I like this kind of coarse humor.
You're real old.
I am old, and maybe this is the movie where
I was told yesterday
my old chickens come home to roost.
I was told yesterday that you didn't like it because you were old.
Yeah, well, I'm sure someone thinks that.
But you're 25. I don't know what you're talking about.
So, you know, as I said before, I think, like, you know, fourth graders and high people love this movie.
Which is fine, because that's also SpongeBob. Like, there's a market for that. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, like, I remember seeing Kentucky Fried Movie in the ninth grade and thinking it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen because it had, like, boobs and swears and all this stuff in it. So I think, like, for younger people who just think that, like, cartoon characters saying the F-bomb a lot is hilarious, they're gonna love that. And obviously I'm in the minority. Most reviews love this movie, so maybe and I loved movie 43, so who knows when it comes to humor, but I just didn't laugh.
I liked it more than you. I laughed much more often than you did, and I was more on board with this thing we were talking about earlier. Using stereotypes to satirize stereotypes.
Right.
That bothered me less, perhaps, than it bothered you. But getting back to the plot for just a moment, what happens is once they learn that their fate is to be eaten and die, that there is no great beyond, it becomes a film about atheism.
Okay.
And, yeah, that's the most interesting.
And that it has. And that is really refreshing to me, because that's not a topic that gets brought up in film often, in mainstream wide release film. So the idea that the entire movie is sort of like a weird, crazy cartoon chick tract for atheism.
Yeah, it's like an atheist parable in a way.
Yeah.
Is interesting to me. The other thing that I thought,
except for the fact that once they finally figure out that you know, that there is no God, that it sort of gives them license to do, like, bizarre and terrible things. And
Well, not even terrible things. I mean, they do. Some of them are terrible, but mostly it's just like, let's all have a, you know.
let's get down.
Let's all get down. Yeah.
Let's have a grown-up party.
So the way it plays out, I found pretty delightful. Having said that, I don't feel as though it, in terms of animation that is R-rated, I don't believe it approaches the shock and the freshness of the way we felt when we saw South Park, the musical movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or even Team America, yeah. This is, I would say it's less than, it's a lesser film than those. Movies. But I think it mostly gets what it wants to do right. I found myself smiling more often than laughing out loud, but when I did laugh out loud, I laughed out loud. I thought the bath salts scene was really great and disgusting.
I did a lot of that face of like, oh, I see where you were going there.
Yeah.
And, oh, that joke's not working.
Let me ask you this, because this is one of the questions I've had as I've thought about going to see it. Does it deliver more than it promises in the previews and trailers? Like, that's sometimes you go see, like, Suicide Squad, for example, where it promises, like, super edgy.
Right.
And from everything I understand, like, it ain't edgy. It's Hot Topic edgy. And this promises edgy, but is there edgy and also a surprising amount of heart? Or edgy and also an interesting viewpoint? Edgy and also...
I'm going to say no, because I think what it's promising is, like, subversive, which it is, but also, like, really inventively funny, which it's not.
Okay.
So it is naughty, but not in a way that is all that entertaining or that means much.
I don't think... Well, first of all, I think the ending sort of knocks it out of the park.
The ending is great, but you got to get there.
But you have to get to the ending.
Yeah.
Also, I don't think it's... I don't think it pats itself on the back for its edginess. I think that it is perfectly in tune with the Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg mindset where naughty, dirty things are presented in a really jovial way.
Okay.
And not in a, look at what we're doing. It's more, it's happier and bouncier and brightly colored and cartoonish.
Yeah.
And because of that, it gets away with it. And yeah. I'm not saying it's great. I'm much more a fan than you are.
Okay. That whole group and all of their work, I've always thought is like that friend you have a really good time with, but you wouldn't invite to like hang out with you and your parents. You know, that kind of where it's not the friend that you take out to show off how great your friends are, but it's the friend that if you wanted to kill an afternoon, you know, getting high and watching Star Wars, like that's your friend. That's that one.
Exactly.
Yeah. I just, you know, I think those guys are, I think there's, their stuff is smart. I think, you know, I kind of see sort of the through line between, like, say, the earlier, better Kevin Smith movies to the earlier, better Judd Apatow movies to what Rogan and his folks are doing now. And I'm a fan of that stuff. And so I feel like, as a fan of that stuff, I am the audience for this movie, and this movie left me cold.
Here's my favorite part of Sausage Party. When I went to buy my ticket at the Grove to see Florence Foster Jenkins...
On Friday morning,
as I walked out, two young moms were hurriedly scooting their children out of the theater.
I'm not
making this up. I was in the right place at the right time. This really happened.
I believe it.
They were hustling those kids, little kids, like five-year-olds, out of Sausage Party. And one of the moms said, I didn't know it was going to be that.
Yep. I worked at a movie theater for a summer, and I worked in the ticket booth every so often, and I was always amazed at people who would walk up and have no idea.
Oh, yeah, constantly.
Watched this old couple like walk up to the posters and just go down them, and it was a poster for The Island. Do you remember that with Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson, I think?
Yeah.
And the tagline was, Plan Your Escape, and they went... Plan Your Escape. Yeah. And they walked up to the booth and said, we would like two tickets for Plan Your Escape. I was like, do you mean The Island? And they're like, yeah. I was like, do you know what it's about? And they're like, nope. And I sold them tickets. And like, they walked out halfway through. And I was like, yeah. Like, you, like, listen, you should probably do a bit of research.
Yeah.
The smallest amount. We did a free movie screening for kids every like Saturday morning or like Wednesday morning. It was like, so like during the summer, you could bring your kids. We did Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a very, like, Bambi-esque, like, parent dying.
Oh, yeah. Dear.
And I was working in the concession stand, and a mother came up to me and started yelling at me because we showed a movie in which a horse died. And I was like, okay, it was free, one, and two, like, yeah, like, that happened. She was like, you guys are monsters. I'm like, we didn't make it.
We didn't show it just so your kid would
traumatized. It worked.
That's a nice plus.
When when both of us were young, we both worked in different movie theaters, and I had the bizarre experience of working in a mall theater in Dallas, but the mall theater was also an art house theater.
What?
It was a swanky mall.
It was a swanky mall with a 5-screen multiplex art house on the skating rink level.
Wow.
And so... folks would come up, tired from shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue, and ask what they should see. And I'd be in the box office, and I'd think, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, none of them.
Because this is for people who've come here specifically for the movie. Don't just wander in. And I remember one night, and I've told this story on the show before a couple of years ago, people came in, and I thought... these are super normal people, and the only thing we might even have for them is the trip to Bountiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, the trip to Bountiful, maybe you'll like that. It's nominated for an Academy Award. So they go in. 30 minutes in, they walk out. They don't even want their money back.
Yeah.
Because they're rich. They're at the fancy mall. And the guy just looks at me and he goes, I'm too effing Bountiful.
Cool.
And I this is my whole 2 years at this place of just constant people constantly, people not getting what they were walking into.
Yeah.
Ever. Having not realizing that there would be subtitles or homosexuality, like the kiss of the Spider-Woman. That was a big one. Or people were like, well, I didn't know this was going to happen in the kiss of the Spider-Woman.
See, I worked at the kind of multiplex where we showed Police Academy.
Right.
See,
you worked at the right one.
Yeah. I've been on the other side of that one time in my entire life, and it was like at the last minute, my older brother called me and was like, hey, you want to go see Pan's Labyrinth? And yeah. I was like, yeah. And I was thinking, this is going to be like an Alice in Wonderland-esque adventure. And I knew it was dark and all that stuff, but like we got there, and subtitles kicked in, and I was like, oh, I wasn't... Okay, that's fine. And then a dude got his face smashed in with a wine bottle, and I was like, oh, what movie is this? What have I done? And I watched the whole thing, and I thought it was just fine.
Okay, so, Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yes.
Meryl Streep is a real lady named Florence Foster Jenkins, and she's a terrible singer, but she loves music.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And she's super rich in New York during World War II.
And this is based on a true story,
right? Story, yes, yes. Yeah. And... Florence Foster Jenkins was a huge supporter of the arts in New York City, and a society lady, and loved opera. And you learn that she also loves to sing. And once, maybe the film is not very good at exploring how she came to be the person she is, even though it's from Stephen Frears, who I expect a lot more from, really. She... perhaps at one point in her life could sing a little, but has lost her voice.
No, she as a child, she played piano.
Yes.
But you come to find out that she contracted syphilis from her first husband. It caused nerve damage in her hand.
She describes him as an alley cat.
And she's treating her syphilis with mercury and arsenic.
The 1940s.
Like you did back in the day.
As a child, she played piano.
Look, it was working. It kept her alive for like 5 decades and still looking like Meryl Streep.
So she could no longer play piano, but she loved music. And so in the film, you see that she goes to see the legendary coloratura Lily Pons perform at Carnegie Hall, and watching Meryl Streep listen to music is something to behold. You know,
I've heard she's a good actress. Is that true? I've never seen her work, but what's she been in?
I'm just saying, you know, the thing about how, like, you know, the thing that actors should know how to do is listen.
Yes.
You know? But you literally are just watching her listen in a close-up, and it's, you know, there's a million things happening. And so after that, she decides, you know, I'm going to take up my singing again. And because she's this huge... supporter of the art, a patron of the arts, like, you know, she's friends with Toscanini and stuff. Like, the vocal coach from the Met comes to her apartment to give her lessons, and so she hires a pianist, this guy who's played by
Simon Helberg,
thank you, from Big Bang Theory.
Yes.
And
also Dr. Horrible sing along blog.
Oh, that too. Yes.
That's what I happen to know him from.
Fair enough. I know him because we saw him on Third once. Anyway.
Yeah, he's our friend from Phone Nuts.
Yes. and he, of course, realizes that she's terrible, but the pay is good. And everyone who around her is always saying positive things. So, like, the Met guy is saying positive things. Her husband, played by Hugh Grant, with whom they have a platonic relationship, and he has a girlfriend on the side, played by Rebecca Ferguson. He's always very supportive. And whenever she performs publicly, usually at, like, the club she founded for music and stuff, he's very tight about who gets in and who doesn't get in. So it's always people who are going to say nice things
applaud and cheer and tell how wonderful she is.
So it's a very, like, cult of personality. Like, she's surrounded by yes people.
Basically, yes. And so then eventually she
decides... Some of whom are literally paid off.
Yes. Yeah, like, he pays off certain journalists to write good reviews of the show. It's like the whole thing. So then she decides that she buys out Carnegie Hall. She gives all these tickets to, like, war veterans. And she's going to give this big public show. And she does a public recording. And so then Hugh Grant has to start working, like, double time to, like, keep her from knowing what's going on. The thing about the movie is it can't quite make up its mind if we're supposed to be mocking her for being untalented and surrounded by enablers, or if we're supposed to admire her.
Lots of scenes of her screeching the songs.
Yeah.
That she...
Gotcha. There's about 8 scenes of her singing badly, which one was plenty.
Yeah.
Or if we're supposed to admire her for, like, sticking to her guns and believing in her dream and, like, not being thwarted by a lack of talent.
That's a bummer, because the preview made it seem like it was that second one, like, it was a movie about follow your dreams.
Yeah, I was thinking about Ed Wood this morning, which is a perfect movie that, like, yes, this guy had no talent at all, and we acknowledged that he had no talent, and people around him kept telling him he had no talent, but he kept doing it anyway, and that is admirable, even if the results were also terrible.
Yeah.
This movie kind of splits the difference, and so it doesn't...
It's a very confused film in that you will see characters react to her negatively, laughing at her, and then later in the film, without any explanation, they are jumping to her defense. And nothing has changed, you are to assume, in these people. Suddenly they're scolding others for laughing at her.
See, this is a shame, because it is one of my favorite story skeletons of that. Like, this is not a weird diversion, I promise. This is a true story. There's a guy named Joshua Norton in turn of the century, 19th century, early 1900s, who invested all of his money in rice from China, because, like, there was an embargo, and it was worth a ton of money, and he invested all of his money in it. Like, 2 weeks later, the embargo was lifted, and he was penniless. And he had a huge mental breakdown, and, like, 2 weeks later came out of, like, hiding and decreed himself the first emperor of America. And, like, he became this, like, public figure that everybody loved, and he had, like, three seats reserved for, like, him and his two dogs at, like, every opening of every opera and blah, blah, blah. And, like, when he died, Mark Twain wrote his epitaph and, like, all this stuff. And that kind of story always gets me, of this idea of, like, we all know that this is silly, but we love them, like, wholeheartedly because of who they are and their dream.
And their belief.
Yeah, and I could very much see where you could write characters who are like, it's okay for us to, like, laugh because we support her, but you're not allowed to do that. Is that not how they write it?
The movie has no real consistent tone about how it feels about her and her relationship to these people, or her relationship to music. And it really doesn't ever dare to address the idea that bad art
can be pleasurable.
Okay.
And so there's... You know, you see critics getting paid off. You see people who are responding on the radio to her recording in a really joyful way. But then they show up to her Carnegie Hall show and laugh out loud at her and clearly are harming her as they do this. And I was genuinely hoping that this would be a film that understood the idea that bad art can be a really wonderful experience.
Yeah, and if it makes you happy.
Not
then.
From a place of mockery, although it can begin there.
Yeah, I like bad movies. Like, correct. There's a whole industry of podcasts based on enjoying bad movies.
There's,
and Pecker is really good at kind of addressing the idea of
an outsider artist.
Yeah,
right.
And that you can be find something ridiculous and admire it at the same time.
Yeah.
I think about, as I watched this, I thought about two films that you and I have really shifted gears on over time.
Mm-hmm.
The 1959 Mexican Santa Claus movie.
Right.
That we both discovered through Mystery Science Theater.
Yes.
And The Apple.
Yeah, I love The Apple.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so when we first saw both of those films, we reacted the way people react the first time they see those films, laughing.
Yeah.
And I think that's an entirely valid place to start. And then over time, I and I believe you as well, we both grew to
admire their
admire their audacity, to admire the psychedelic qualities of both of those films.
You became familiar with them.
Yeah. And to understand them as a type of movie that is somewhat mysterious and completely wild and unconcerned with ideas about quality.
Yeah.
You know, they just wanted to get the thing done that they wanted to get done, and they did it.
I mean,
and it's goofy and weird, and there's a never-ending strangeness to these films. But as I watch them now, and I still want to watch these films over and over again, I love them.
Yeah.
And I'm not laughing really anymore. I'm just enjoying myself.
I'm curious to see what the Criterion release of Valley of the Dolls does.
Yes.
To that movie's reputation, because that's a movie that has sort of legendarily always been known as this campy, ridiculous, over-the-top film. And I'm wondering if the repackaging of it as a Criterion title will now sort of make it this kind of like artifact of the 60s and proto-feminist whatever. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
Because the book certainly seems to have had that kind of reevaluation.
Yes.
It's a weird thing. It bums me out because I think that it seems like they're blind to the inherent purpose of the movie then, because there were lots of okay singers that probably people liked a lot that no one's making movies about.
Right.
So it seems like the beauty of this person was she wasn't very good, but her commitment and the fact that everybody loved her and supported her, like that's why her story is still being told.
There was actually another French movie this year where they changed the names, but it's the same story.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I have no idea what their tack was. I didn't see that one.
I don't know what that is.
Is there a payoff? Like, is it a forced payoff or is it a well-earned payoff?
It is a forced payoff. Yeah. And the only interesting...
There are some nice scenes along the way.
The only interesting thing going on here is the visual story of Meryl Streep and her face and her body and her gestures and her magically near crying eyes and her sighs and her inflections. Like, she's the world's greatest violin and everything around her is orchestrally supporting her, even though that orchestra doesn't actually make very much sense at all.
She has a really great scene with Helberg, where they talk about music.
About her past and... Yeah.
There's a scene where, like, Hugh Grant dances at a party and it's just this sudden moment of, like, exuberance.
Yeah.
Okay, this movie's coming to life for a few minutes.
It's very disappointing, and I expect more from Stephen Frears in terms of a story that is about something other than don't hurt people's feelings by laughing at them.
It was between those two movies for me this morning, and it was only because it was 9 a.m. that I was like, I think I'm more in the mood for Pete's Dragon than I am for Florence Foster Jenkins. But I will say that seeing the previews, like, my wife and I were like,
heartwarming.
Yeah. And I also was very, and this is going to sound weird, but I was very happy to see Hugh Grant cast opposite Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
Where it seems like normally they'd cast Hugh Grant opposite someone 20 years younger than him.
Yes.
Or they'd cast someone 30 years older than Meryl Streep to play I know that that's a pittance of a promise in a movie, but enough for me to be like, hey, that's at least different enough that I could see them being in some sort of relationship with each other, reasonably, realistically.
In an age-appropriate way.
As you said earlier, I don't know. But I believe that Ms. Streep tends to get Ms. Streep's way.
Oh, yes.
And
she's been in some stuff before. I don't know. Have you guys seen any of her other work? I hear she's really good.
But no, it's interesting because... So
I think other people in the cast, I think they might have to go to her and say, so how do you feel about blah, blah, blah?
Yeah.
No.
But she's working with Stephen Frears, which is a big deal because she's gotten, I think, some well-deserved flack over the years about not working with the best directors. Like, she's considered, you know, like our best actress right now.
And she works with directors she can boss around.
She works with people like the woman who made, you know, Mamma Mia and The Iron Lady, whose name I don't even know. You know, or the guy who made Devil Wears Prada, whose name I don't know.
Right.
You know, or like John Wells on August Osage County. But so,
I like it. I like the way you just said his name. John Wells.
Well, come on. he's whatever. So, she's finally working with somebody who's going to, you would think, maybe bring her A game. And not that, there's nothing wrong with the movie that's her fault. But the movie is just kind of a hot mess, unfortunately. And now I'm really curious what The Disaster Artist is going to be like, which is the James Franco Tommy Wiseau movie. It's like, is that going to be...
Have you read that book, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
I heard the audiobook. It's great.
It's so good.
Yes.
Here's one thing you're going to miss, not living in Los Angeles. If you stayed here, you might get to stand with Tommy Wiseau in the post office line like I do about every other week. Yeah.
Ooh. I'll come back and just visit the post office.
These are pleasures that are going to be denied you now that you're moving away.
It's a wonderful point because my two favorite bad movies are The Room and The Apple.
Yeah.
And The Room specifically I love because it's something When you talk about really great, enjoyable bad movies, it's not something... I don't think... If anyone ever sets out to make a bad movie, like, write that off. You know what I mean?
It doesn't work.
But what you see in the room is somebody working really hard to make a movie how they think a movie is supposed to be made.
Yeah.
And, like, listen, there are many... You've Got Mail. It's, like, a perfectly fine movie that's very enjoyable.
Right.
I could write books about The Room and The Apple.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, those are way more fascinating to try to figure out, to try to, like, dissect, like, a crime scene, what happened there and what was going on. We're like, that's far more interesting to me to see someone try really hard and do it their way.
Yep.
And their way just happens to be bonkers.
Right.
And the only difference between that and, like, some kind of, like, art house, I didn't understand it, but everyone tells me it's a good movie, is everyone acknowledges The Room is bad. But, like... If everybody came out and was like, The Room is a brilliant piece of genius, people were like, yeah, it's great. Yeah, what they said.
We agree.
Uh-huh, it's great, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the best bad movies always have this sort of air of mystery. It's like, who is this guy? Where did he come from? Who gave him money? And, you know, like, there was a movie called After Last Season. You might have seen the trailer, because the trailer was so bad, people thought it was actually viral marketing for another film.
For Where the Wild Things Are.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it literally, the last line in the film is somebody saying, I think there's some printers in the basement you can use. Like, that's their big cap off. It's the movie that has the MRI machine made out of paper.
Cool.
Anyway, but the guy who directed it, like, didn't
to this day, I'm not unconvinced that it might be an art prank.
It's cool. The computer graphics are decades out of date. Like, just so sort of early kind of Amiga kind of things. Harsh lighting, like, where people just are casting giant shadows, and dialogue that's never about anything. It's like, well, I've never been to that town, but I've driven through it. You know, just it's
that's
bananas.
Awesome. After Last Season, you say.
It's really hard to find. Might be a DVD.
If I can, I'll try and get it.
Perfect.
We're done.
All right, so we'll circle back to Hell or High Water next week, which also had a big launch this week, but. In only a handful of theaters, it's going to go wider next time. But it's an interesting movie, and we'll...
Can I say one last thing about Beast Dragon?
Oh, please.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that I would recommend it for people with kids 10 and under.
That's fair.
Yeah. I was thinking about that as I was watching it, and I was just like, there's a lot of difficult concepts in here.
When I was seven, eight years old, I thought I was grown.
What?
What if they come like five minutes
Yeah, if you
late?
Skip the first 5 minutes, I think it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Skip all that death.
If you skip, because that opening scene is like, that could really mess a kid up.
It's traumatic to watch. Yeah. I don't know. You know what? When I was like 7 or 8 years old, I thought I was grown.
Yeah.
I was ready for everything. And you know, I was like, oh, see the scary movies now. And, you know, so 8 or 9. I'll agree with you, maybe like 8 or 9 years old.
I want to comment on a quiet thing that I don't know if it's actually in the movie. It's never drawn attention to, but it's a Disney movie in which an unmarried couple seems to be living together.
That's right.
Where I was like, hey, too. Hey, whoa, hello.
Like, you're brushing your teeth at his house.
Hold on. And like, that was a moment where I was like, hey, Disney, nice. Okay, just kind of like snuck that in there.
Right.
And also that they didn't ever make a big deal about like, where's Natalie's mom? What's the deal with her mom? And where, like, I was expecting something like that. And it was like, no, that's not the story. That's not the story. Like, there were good things about it. I was watching with a very critical eye.
Fair enough. Well, we never do that.
Yeah.
Travis, thank you for being here. This has been a delight. Where can people find you online?
The easiest place is to go to McElroyShows.com, McElroy, and you can find all 7 of my podcasts, 8 if you count Till Death Do Us Part. You can also find my brother's other podcasts. All together, we do something like 13 or 14 podcasts.
Ooh, you have an empire.
And then they also do a lot of like YouTube stuff with Polygon, where they work now. You can also just go on iTunes. 6 of my 8 podcasts are on MaximumFun.org, so you can check that out.
And you're at Travis McElroy.
I'm at Travis McElroy, McElroy.
And TravisMcElroy.com.
Yeah, Travis McElroy. I often forget that I have a website. I do a lot of work to update it, then I forget about it promptly for 9 months.
But you made it on that site that advertises on every show but this one, so, you know, hooray. All right. No, thank you for being here. This was a delight. We saw you guys live years ago at Downtown Independent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a while ago. Yeah.
We were standing in line in front of, not realizing, Drew Davenport.
Oh, how did you not realize he's a giant?
He is a giant.
He's like 9 feet tall.
I had no idea that that person was a giant. I just, hey, who's this guy?
Who's this giant man?
And then when y'all gave him a shout, I'm like, oh, that guy. Okay, yeah, my line buddy. All right. Thank you all for listening. As always, check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney, The Schmoes Know, Dennis Henry with Dennis Hensley, The Sewers of Paris, The Joe Al Ryan Thing, The Brett Easton Ellis podcast, The Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting, SVU, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Thank you, Blue, for our amazing theme music. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. We got a hilarious 5-star review on iTunes. I'll read it next time, but it was complimentary and kind of insulting, but it was okay.
Well, not in a mean way, but does take us to task on some things.
Yeah.
Apparently,
there's
the
implication that we're sort of snooty.
We're elitist and snooty.
What?
But in a sweet way, apparently. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. We will be catching up more on letters in the weeks to come. And this was great. We'll talk to you guys later.
Goodbye.